Rock Podcast, talking all things Disney with your hosts, Eljon Goh and Dave Bossert.
Welcome to the Skull Rock Podcast, where every week we talk to you about all things Disney and pop culture, and we take you behind the scenes of some of your favorite Disney films, theme park attractions, performances, books, music, what's streaming, what's in theaters, what's going on in the universe of entertainment. I'm Eljon Goh, longtime Disney, Marvel, Star Wars, pop culture fan and musician. And you can email me at dave@skullrockpodcast.com and calling from an undisclosed location in the middle of, I don't know where. We have Dave.
And I'm Dave Bossert, artist, filmmaker, author, and on the road again with the Skull Rock Podcast.
There you are, Dave. Look at you.
If you love Disney and pop culture, please subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. You can also like and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and LinkedIn. You can also email me at dave@skullrockpodcast.com. How you doing, Eljon?
I'm good.
On the road again. I'm in New York, broadcasting from the mobile Skull Rock Podcast studios.
I love it. We're doing good. You know, we celebrated the CMA week here in Nashville. It was quite busy. The year anniversary of the Gibson Garage, which I am definitely involved in, and Les Paul's birthday on Thursday. I mean, it was just a bunch of music and mayhem, merry mayhem here in the Music City. So,
well, I'll tell you, Les Paul's a legend. Yeah. I know who he is.
Yeah.
But what is the Gibson Garage?
So the Gibson Garage is a flagship store experience, part museum, part retail showcase, part performance venue. And because the Country Music Association, like the Fan Fest, is going on this week and tons of concerts, you know, Carrie Underwood and Darius Rucker and everyone involved in country music are performing here. Every stage in Nashville is lit up. Of course, it coincides with the year anniversary of this mega experience opening in Nashville at Cummins Station, which is where the Gibson headquarters and the office is, where I work. And so we had the stages full of just wonderful musicians, and you know, from different genres when it comes to folk and rock, you know, hard rock and country, and everyone sharing the stage playing their beautiful Gibson guitars, and we were celebrating it all, including Les Paul's birthday, which was amazing. So
it's fantastic. I mean, the Gibson Les Paul is a classic, right? Now, correct me if I'm wrong. Is it the Sunburst?
Yeah. So the vintage Sunburst, the gold top, you know, those are just in the Les Paul custom, the tuxedo, as a lot of people call it, the fretless wonder. I mean, it's wonderful. Les Paul is in the Musician and Inventors Hall of Fame for all the contributions he's done with music. And he was quite the virtuoso, and, you know, working for Gibson and continuing that legacy of just innovation and wonderful music is just an honor for me to be a part of, and just an iconic guitar and man behind the guitar. So
yeah.
So it's really cool.
I've seen some interviews with him over the years. He seemed like a really cool guy, and he was a great musician himself.
Absolutely. I mean, the Les Paul model guitar is a guitar that he endorsed for the company, and he was one of the very first artists to be on TV at that caliber. Him and Mary Ford, you know, had a weekly variety show, and he would play all kinds of great music, and he was a great musician, jazz and pop musician at that time. And he was a virtuoso, and that's why the name lives on, and probably one of the most popular guitars of all time, the Les Paul. So
it's awesome.
Yeah, it's great. And of course, CMA is country music, you know, I mean, so it's been just a very busy time in Music City, and summertime is in full swing. And then you're on the road too, you know, doing a lot of stuff. You're just keeping busy out there as always, Dave.
I am. And, you know, while I've been in New York, I had a chance on Friday to go in and see the Winslow Homer Cross Current show at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, the Met, up in, near Central Park in Manhattan. And it was a fantastic show. I mean, just really fantastic show. Many of his iconic paintings and watercolors, his oils and watercolors, were on display. So it was really cool being able to see I think one of his most famous paintings, the Gulf Stream, to actually see the painting right there in front of you, you know, the actual painting. And also another one of his iconic images is Breezing Up, a fair wind, and just really gorgeous paintings. I really enjoyed the show. I hope people have a chance to see it. If they're in New York or in the surrounding area, make it a point. The show is running at the Met until July 31st. And if you don't have a chance to go to New York, you should really check out the Winslow Homer Cross Currents book that they put together on the entire exhibition. It basically has reproductions of all the paintings in the book that are in the show, plus some wonderful text. So, and that's just me saying, you know, I bought the book because I thought it was a beautiful book, and I'm not plugging anybody who's, you know, who wrote it or whatever, but it does help the museum when you do purchase those books.
It's a beautiful thing to not only have art in that form touch your life, because you have to, you know, I love looking at architecture and art. And when I go into a gallery and I look at the art and you really study it for what it is, not only does it just evoke emotion and you wonder and marvel at the genius of the people that are behind it, how it's created and how long it took them to create that. It's just, it's something to marvel at. I don't think a lot of people can stop and take the time to really look and appreciate that. So if you can go out and seek out your art, your local art galleries, and support them by getting those books, support those artists. That's amazing stuff.
Yeah, it was good stuff. So, you know, it's been a busy week, I have to say. Yeah. You know, with traveling and all that. I did manage to squeeze in a movie.
Oh, what did you see?
I saw Crimes of the Future, which is the latest David Cronenberg directed film starring Viggo Mortensen.
Yeah, yeah.
And I would say save your money.
Oh, no.
You know, I really am a fan of Viggo Mortensen as an actor. I loved him in The Green Book, mm-hmm. And quite a number of other films. And I have to say, this one, I when the movie ended, I was like, what was the point here?
Ouch.
You know, it was a sort of a dystopian, futuristic, you know, about people, you know, the humans' bodies evolving to consume plastic waste and things. It was just kind of weird and just wasn't my cup of tea.
Oh, it's so strange. You know, it's funny. Some of the best films follow a very basic, you know, opening statement. This is what the film's about. We're going to take you through that journey of the character, and then we're going to give you a satisfying result. That's all you have to do, folks. That's all you have to do.
Yeah, this one was just too much. You know, it was interesting. It was shot in Greece, you know, there was a lot of derelict boats and ships and things like that, which was kind of interesting. But you know, just overall, I was let down by the film.
Oh, that's a shame. Well, what else did you happen to see? Did you see anything else?
I watched a little TV before I left on this trip, and I watched a few episodes of City Homicide, which is available on Freevee, and it's an Australian TV series. And, you know, it's a crime type thing. It ensemble cast. It was entertaining.
Nice.
Very much like, you know, SVU or one of those types of
procedural
that you guys enjoy. Yeah, it was very much procedural, but enjoyable.
Nice.
Know?
All right. Well, there you go.
What about you? What have you been up to? What have you been watching?
Well, I had my wife and I and the family had every intention of seeing Jurassic World Dominion this weekend, and that ain't going to happen. It's too hot here, Dave. We have heat warnings here in Nashville, like 100 degrees. We're going to hit like triple digits here.
And you got humidity, right?
And the humidity. Yeah. Yesterday I was out there putting, I never thought I could get excited about putting in a brand new sprinkler system in our house, but I did. And I loved it and it was wonderful, but yes, no, we're not doing that right now, but we will see it eventually. But what we did see is Miss Marvel debuting on Disney Plus, and I have to say, I really, really enjoyed it. I thought the title star, she was amazing. Such a young actress and so promising in the future. I thought the writers, of course, are amazing. I believe they're all Pakistanian, which is great. I've been to Pakistan and I love the people. I thought it was really well done, very authentic to the culture, but as a piece of the story and not the entire story. The entire story is really what connects human beings, which is coming of age, finding yourself, finding strength within. And so those are universal things. It doesn't really matter what culture or religion you're at. It's universal, which this really hits. So I'm really excited about that. It's kind of like, do you remember... It does have some inklings of like a high school drama, like, you know, Spider-Man did, you know, in the high school thing. But there was a comic book, what is it, Scott Pilgrim versus the World. Did you remember that from maybe 10 years ago?
I do remember that. I vaguely remember the title.
Yeah. So it has some of that kind of art. You know, because she is an independent, she's a YouTube filmmaker and loves animation and drawing. So a lot of the stuff you'll see are when she's doing her internal monologue, she's thinking in terms of the art and it's drawing, you know, while she's thinking, you know. So there's a lot of those little flourishes in the film over live action that look really, really well done, and reminds me of the comic book, which I love. So I can't go on more about it. It's just so good. So check it out. And then
I will.
Firestarter. So we saw this on Peacock. This hit theaters last month, I believe, and it's streaming on Peacock. And Zac Efron, once again, he's come such a long way from High School Musical. I mean, he did great in, I think he did he played the killer. I'm trying to remember the killer movie that he did, but he played a serial killer not too long ago, which was great. And he's doing great work here in Firestarter. I thought the little girl was really good too. It's hard to beat the original. I'm a big Stephen King fan and the original film was great, but this is pretty good. So okay. It's definitely a thumbs up for me.
Yeah.
And then the Escape Room Tournament of Champions. So as you know, big horror movie fans. And this was okay. So this gets a meh for me. It doesn't have the heart of the original. Everything is pretty contrived. It's kind of like the Saw films. The Saw movie, the original, like the first couple of ones were really good. The one with Chris Rock was really good. The last Saw movie. Everything else is kind of meh. It's good. I didn't feel like it was a waste of time, but it's definitely something where I could take it or leave it. And then, of course, the Orville, going back to Seth MacFarlane's brilliance. He makes Star Trek better than Star Trek right now, in my opinion. And this next episode that they just dropped on Hulu is amazing. And I think they found a new kind of villain, like Star Trek and the Enterprise crew, you know, fought against the Borg. I think they found their new villain. There's my little girl screaming. She loves the Orville, too.
I mean, she sounds excited about the Orville.
She's excited about the Orville. There's no doubt. Anyway, Dave, that's all I have to say this week. Those are some decent picks for me.
Awesome. I'm going to make it a point to check out Miss Marvel when I get back to Los Angeles.
I can't wait. I can't wait to hear what you have to say about it. But we do have a couple things. We have an awesome guest in the green room. Why don't we tease people about our guest?
We do. You know something? We had a listener write into us a couple of months ago suggesting that we do a show celebrating Ron Miller. Ron Miller was the former CEO of the Walt Disney Company, and he was also Walt Disney's son-in-law. And so I reached out to a friend of the show, Don Hahn. Everybody knows Don Hahn, the legendary animation Love producer that. And all-around Renaissance man. We are bringing Don on to have a conversation about Ron Miller and all the things he accomplished while he was at the Walt Disney Company.
Yeah.
So I'm excited about it. It should be a very good show. So stay tuned for that. But first,
before we even do that, don't forget you can enter to win the Claude Coates book. So the new Claude Coates book is back in stock. Claude Coates, Walt Disney Imagineer, The Making of Disneyland from Toad Hall to Haunted Mansion and Beyond. And it's signed by Dave and Alan Coates. And you know, Alan, the son of Claude Coates, both of them working in Imagineering, and both of them have, just amazing contributions to Disney. But this Claude Coates book is an award-winning, awesome book. And if you live in the United United States, you have an opportunity to win. All you have to do is go to our Facebook page. A show notes link will be down there. And at the end of the month, we will be pulling out a winner. And you will win this amazing signed book from Dave. So
plus a bunch of little extras.
Yeah.
I'm going to throw some extras in on that.
I love it. All right. So that plus. And that's what you can expect here on the show. And especially with our giveaway. So now, without further ado...
Skull Rock Podcast, this week in Disney and pop culture.
All right, Jurassic World headed for a 15 million opening day. And this was just, you know, a few days ago. I don't even know what the trades are saying.
I can tell you that the box office for the weekend was estimated at 143.4 million opening domestically.
Oh, man.
I mean, that's, again, I think people are just chomping at the bit, Al John, to get back into the movie theaters and see some of these major tentpole films, you know? And I have to say, I'm just pulling this up because I want people to realize that globally, as of Sunday, there's a total of 389 million as the box office recovery continues to gain momentum, according to the Hollywood Reporter. So pretty phenomenal.
I agree 100%. I mean, that is huge. And then not to mention Top Gun Maverick is still, right behind it. And they have what, 400 billion? What? I don't even know how much they made.
You know something, it's just exploding at the box office. It's breaking records for Tom Cruise movies. Mm.
Rightfully so, man. The box office is back. Movies are back. And thank you for supporting the movie industry. We'll talk more about what's going on in the box office. There's interesting news from Disney. Hollywood insiders are stunned. I am stunned at how Bob Chapek ousted Peter Rice. You know, we just talked about Peter Rice renewing his contract here not too long ago on the show.
Yeah.
Peter Rice being head of the streaming services, platform movies, etc. So can you tell us a little bit about what's going on here?
You know, this is Machiavellian type stuff that's going on here. I think that Chapek viewed Peter Rice as potentially competition for his job and unceremoniously fired him. This shocked people in Hollywood, Al John, I have to tell you. Yeah. This was a shaker around the industry because it does a number of things. It's not only, you know, being disrespectful to Peter Rice, who's a well-respected executive in Hollywood. It was not only disrespectful how they treated him, but it sends a message to all these other talented executives in town. Like, do they really want to go work for Disney if they're treating people this way? And it's a further blow to the low morale already at the company. There's a lot of people on the inside that I've talked to that are just, you know, the morale is not that great at the Disney company right now. And this is contributing to it, this type of stuff. And it's really kind of surprising.
Well, now this is rumored, of course. Well, what is not rumored is the fact that he fired Rice. So Rice is out and the scuttlebutt is exactly what you say. I totally understand that. But being a dysfunctional company move, having dysfunctional company moves, as we've seen over the past year and a half during the pandemic, it's hard for me to defend Chapek and these type of things because they're so visible. It's so shocking. It's so disrespectful how people have been treated in terms of talent. It's like, I can't defend this guy anymore. He's hanging himself here.
Here's the thing I'll say about this. Look what happened over at Discovery Warner Brothers, right? Mm-hmm. They just finished a big merger, and there's a lot of executive change-ups happening. Toby Emmerich, who was heading up film production over at Warner Brothers, he was being let go. But you know what they did? They gave him a production deal, right? They're like, okay, we don't want you in this role anymore, but we're going to give you a production deal. It's a nice way to segue an executive out. And that's what they do in this town. You know, they could have easily done that with Peter Rice. They could have given him a production deal, or they could have done something to make this not a big story. It seems like, you know, Chapek seems to be taking you know, the hard way on some of these things, you know.
Well, and Disney showing. Did that, and Disney did that not too long ago with the Disney Plus. There was someone that was working at Disney Plus we talked about, and he'd segued into their own production. We kind of knew that this was the situation of things, that they're making way for another talent to come in their place. And Tim Rice actually was courted. He was getting ready to do, you know, before his contract was renewed last year, was actually going to leave the Disney company and get into another executive, highly executive position at another film studio. And they kept him. And now they're going to have to pay a severance and everything. But isn't that like one of those things where, yeah, we're going to sign you to a record deal and then we're going to put you on the shelf because you're competing against someone else and then you're never going to be heard from again?
Yeah, it's just terrible. I just, you know, further that this just further damages the Disney image. It tarnishes it in the eyes of people. And of course, in the eyes of talent, you know, who wants to be, you know, dissed like this? I don't know. It's going to be interesting, Al John, to see how this unfolds over the next 6 to 8 months, because JPEG's contract is up in February. And regardless of the board coming out and saying they fully support him, it's going to be interesting to see how this all plays out.
Well, you said it. That's exactly where I was going. Disney stock plummeted a few points too when this was all said and done. And February is going to be a, as we say in the business, come to Jesus meeting. So here we go. D23 Expo, Dave, has been announced. You know, Disney is going to be celebrating its 100th birthday at the D23 Expo next year. And they have a huge slate of programming for the Hall D23, the 69-seat venue. They've basically broken up a lot of their programming. We have Friday, September 9th, the Disney 100 celebration kicks off. We've got the live-action Pixar Animation Studio and Walt Disney Animation does, I guess, they're kind of their upfronts, right? They kind of, here's everything we have coming up. And then they also will be packaging the Disney Legends Ceremony that I absolutely love. So that's Friday. Saturday, we're going to have the big studios from Marvel and Lucasfilm showcase a lot of stuff going on in Hall D23. As well as the Disney Plus panel that'll be happening as well. And then Sunday, they're breaking it up again. Disney Parks and Experiences Products with Josh D'Amaro is going to be there, plus the Disney Princess Concert featuring all the Disney legends. So tickets are on sale for one day, $99 for one day. Children at $79 for one day passes. All the 3 day passes, I believe, are sold out. And I believe Saturday is already sold out as well.
I believe you're right.
Yeah, so get them while you can. You know, this year we're skipping out. We always attend D23. We love seeing the panels. We love seeing the legends specifically. But Dave, you know, do you have any plans on maybe doing the D23 Expo?
No, you know, I'm out of town. I'm out of town for 2 weeks when the Expo's happening. And it's, you know, I don't know why they're doing it in September. It just seems odd to me to do it in September. I feel like it this is a summer type of thing, you know, do it in August, but they're choosing to do it in September.
I think part of it is because they are doing this synergy with Disney Plus Day that usually happens in the fall, October, November timeframe. Yeah. So they're kind of meeting somewhere in the middle so they can do all their slate, you know, and all their press in one situation. And yeah, I don't know if they typically do their upfronts around the same time. I can't remember. So maybe a little bit late to do the upfronts for TV. Yeah. But anyway, D23 Expo. Now, here's another thing. So last week we talked a little bit about how the trolls of the internet are coming out to basically put a kibosh on the Obi-Wan series, which is, by the way, amazing. Another thing I've been watching is Obi-Wan. This past episode I thought was great. You know, it's not a perfect show, but it's great. But here they are, Dave, coming out of the woodwork to bash Ms. Marvel. And just like they did last week, you know, to that actress. And this is, I don't know why these so-called fans come out and then they start using these derogatory terms based on, you know, whatever they think, you know, this franchise is about with Ms. Marvel. Ms. Marvel has been a name in the comic books for a long time. And this iteration of Ms. Marvel has been around since like 2012, 2013, and is a great story. I don't know why people continually try to review bomb these shows, these trolls, and maybe a lot of them with racism, you know, involved. And I hate to even call them fans.
You know, like I said, I think last week or the week before, I don't want to give these baboons a platform. Mm-hmm. I really don't. They don't deserve it. You know, I think they should be ignored. They shouldn't even write stories about these people because, you know, they're useless. This kind of stuff is unacceptable as far as I'm concerned. And I ignore this type of stuff. And that's what you have to do, because if you talk about it, you're giving them a platform. You're putting them on a pedestal to talk about what they're doing. And I don't want to talk about it.
Okay. Well, fair enough. And I believe you're right. What I can't tell you, which is positive, and you know my feeling on this, is that Marvel is gearing up for their next phase, and they just recently enlist director Jake Shearer, did I say that right, for Thunderbolts. Black Widow writer Eric Pearson is penning the script. Dave, you know that these anti-heroes, if you will, of the villains of the Marvel Universe are going to come together and do kind of this shadowy kind of Avengers thing, the Dark Avengers, if you will. It's going to be comprised of the Taskmaster from Black Widow, as well as Yelena Belova from Florence Pugh, U.S. Agent Wyatt Russell, and then, of course, headed by Julia Louis-Dreyfus, who's kind of putting, she's kind of like the dark figure equivalent to Nick Fury and Samuel L. Jackson. She's putting this group of just kind of ambiguously gray. They operate in the gray morality of the Marvel universe. Yes. And what do you think about this? This is great. And
we've already seen Julia Louis-Dreyfus in a couple of films already.
Yeah.
You know, she's made an appearance. So I'm looking forward to this. I think it's fantastic. And I do like the sort of anti-heroes and, you know, the darker side, but they're still doing some good.
Yeah, it seems like they're taking a page out of the DC book and like Suicide Squad, but not as funny. You know?
Right, very cool.
Looking forward to that. Hey, Dave, you know, Marvel has a way of re-releasing films so that they'll cross the threshold, if you will. They're going to do it again. Sony and Marvel teaming up for No Way Home, the More Fun Stuff edition, hitting the theaters in September with additional footage of Spidey in celebration of the 60th anniversary. It's going to go on sale in limited release Tuesday, August 9th. There's a bunch of press going on for this. Tom Holland, Andrew Garfield, and Tobey Maguire talking about the three Spider-Man meme. I'm Spider-Man. I'm Spider-Man. I'm Peter Parker. I'm Peter Parker. And so additional footage, Dave.
I love this. I absolutely love it. I'm going to go see this when it comes out in September. I loved it the first time around, and to see a version that has more stuff in it is going to be really interesting. I think that's terrific.
I love it.
Look, it's a great marketing thing. Disney has done this all the time, you know, with anniversaries. They put in sequences that were cut out of films. They put them back in. They finish them. They do things for anniversaries. And it just, you know, brings more interest to the film property. And I think this is terrific.
Yeah, and I think they also have done additional special effects, too, to make that, you know, once again, Dave, I think they were really under the gun to get all the special effects done and try to keep it under the veil of secrecy. And now that they have, you know, everyone knows the film, they're really putting the finishing touches on it. And I can't wait for it to come out, because I will see it again for sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
Sarah Chaudhry and Anders Holm joined the musical comedy The Muppets Mayhem for Disney Plus. So you might know Chandra Chaudhry, the mysterious Benedict Society. I think you've seen some of that. And then
she's
starring in Holly Hobby. Anders Holm, who's featured in Workaholics and Inventing Anna, have been cast as Hannah and JJ in this live action series that feature the Electric Mayhem band, you know, Dr. Teeth and them, all of them, Janice on the Les Paul, by the way,
Floyd Animal Pepper, on drums.
Animal on drums, of course. So they're all there. And we're looking forward to seeing this as it hits Disney Plus with the Muppet Studio later. I think it's going to be early next year, I think, is when they have it.
So your daughter's super excited like I am about this, because I love everything Muppets. I can't wait to see this.
I can't wait either. Oh my goodness me. Oh my. May oh my. Some sad news. Got to play one of my favorite bands, Bon Jovi. I'm Living on a Prayer. Dave, Bon Jovi, founded in New Jersey, just a hop skip away from you, where you grew up, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So we have sad news here. Bon Jovi founding bassist Alec John Such passes away at the age of 70. The Rock and Roll Inducted Hall of Fame player was on the first five albums, of course, hits like Living on a Prayer, Wanted Dead or Alive, and I Am Friends with the Bon Jovi Camp Indeed, and they said, quote, "We are heartbroken to hear the news of the passing of our dear friend Alec John Such. He was an original founding member of Bon Jovi, and Alec was integral to the formation of the band. We found our way to each other through him, through Tico Torres, the drummer, and Richie Sambora. It is sad when these things happen, Dave.
Did it say what happened to him? I mean, it seems awfully, it says no cause of death was provided, but I mean, 70s young.
70s young. 70s young, for sure.
Holy mackerel.
Yeah, you know, Alec hadn't been performing live with a band for a long time, Dave. He hasn't been a member of the band for a long time. He was a touring guy. So who knows? Regardless, we do once again wish condolences and our heartfelt thoughts for his family and all of his fans. And another story, Dave, another great band. This is one of our favorite songs. Is it not, Dave? Seals and Croft.
Oh, fantastic.
Summer Breeze. Man. I play this song, especially this chorus. Here we go. Summer breeze makes me feel fine. Blowing through the jasmine in my mind. What a great guitar riff. Down, down, down. Anyway, I love that riff. We have one of
I was just going to say, what a great band. And this was a real surprise to me to see that Jim Seals passed away at the age of 79. I mean, you know, the iconic songs from that 70s period, you know, that really speak to, whenever I hear a Summer Breeze, I mean, it speaks to the summer for me, you know?
Yeah, indeed. And I remember, you know, listening to that growing up, it's just such an iconic song. Jim Seals, half of the soft rock troubadour Seals and Crofts, died Monday at the age of 79. And the passing was for an unspecific ongoing chronic illness. So it's very sad indeed. But once again, you know, we don't live forever, but the music will, for Bon Jovi and Seals and Crofts.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Now, it's time to get on with our guest of the week, Don Hahn.
Let's do it.
Skull Rock Podcast, interview time.
Well, Al John, once again, we have a fantastic guest, and this was prompted by one of our listeners who wrote in and suggested that we do a show about Ron Miller because he really hasn't been talked about very much in recent years and had a big impact on the Walt Disney Company. So we went to our pal, none other than the legendary animation producer and modern day Renaissance man, Don Hahn.
Hi, everybody. Thank you all. And
yes, our studio audience is going wild for you, Don, as always.
Thank you all.
So, Don, you know, when I started at the Walt Disney Company in early 84, mm-hmm. thanks to you, as I always remind you. I was sort of in that period, that transition period. It was sort of the end of Ron Miller's era and the beginning of the Michael Eisner, Frank Wells, Jeffrey Katzenberg era. And I didn't really know Ron Miller very well, other than I said hi to him a few times in the hallway. He was a very friendly guy. Yeah. But you were there for many years before I got there. And you must have crossed paths and knew him, and then later on in the years got to see him more frequently.
Yeah, I think that, you know, I was I started in 1976 and I was 20, and I was kind of part of the group of people that started, like Glenn Keane and Tim Burton and John Lasseter and Ron Clements, John Musker, that gang. And so Ron was our boss. You know, he was the buck stops here kind of guy. And along with Card Walker, who was, you know, kind of around at the same time. Card was very much about the parks and about the administration and not as much of a creative executive, I would say. And it's interesting because Card came from the camera department. He was a, you know, camera operator and multiplane camera operator. Ron came from football, and he had a very big cast a long shadow, partially because he was 6'5" and, you know, weighed probably 250 or 300 pounds, no joke, a football player at USC and later at the Los Angeles Rams. And so he's a big guy. Really, as you said, did a lot for the company and kind of established a lot. So I didn't really know him personally at all in the earliest days, except to be in some meetings and present to him or whatever. I really knew him much, much more recently when he and Diane Disney Miller were doing the Walt Disney Family Museum. Then for some reason, I think there was a small group of people, Pete Docter, and there's a few people that were very flattered to be pulled into trying to help build that museum. And by build, I mean consult. So every once in a while we would go up and suggest things to Ron and Diane, and they built, of course, the amazing Walt Disney Family Museum up there. So it's a lot to do with the legacy of the company. He left in 84 when Michael Eisner and Frank Wells came into the company, and that was a very, difficult time for everybody, and we can talk about that, but that's kind of the headlines of Ron Miller.
Yeah, but I think, if we go back, like, he was born in Los Angeles. He came from a working class family. His mother apparently worked at a candy factory and his father was a tire salesman.
Yeah, he was born in Watts, which we think of as an African-American community. But he used to tell stories about watching the Goodyear blimp take off from the airfield near Watts. And so he was a real Los Angeles guy. None of this Midwestern stuff. He was born and bred in Los Angeles. And I think that did lead him to, and it was probably a little more on the athletic side than the academic side, but still surprisingly savvy when it came to, what he did over the future years of running the company. Really interesting guy.
I was going to ask you, do you think that really was because Walt Disney took him under his wing? I mean, Ron met Diane Disney through a blind date, from what I understand. And and as they started getting serious, do you think Walt basically took his future son-in-law under his arm, under his wing, so to speak, and guided him and was a tutor, a mentor to him?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, Walt did not have any sons, and I think Walt was still of the generation where the son, the firstborn, the male of the family, kind of a very European tradition of passing your legacy and your estate onto the firstborn man of the family. And that seems like a very old-fashioned notion these days, and rightly so. But I think back then, Walt was always looking for, who am I going to pass this on to? And of course, Ron, I think, represented that. And a little bit later, Ron and Diane had their first male child, who they named Walter Elias, Disney Miller. And how would you like to grow up with that name?
Wow.
I think that was a lot of it, just a reasonably traditional point of view of who's going to mind the store. And I'm not sure, I honestly don't know how much Diane was interested in doing that. I suspect she wasn't. She was very involved in raising her kids and very involved in her own interests. But I think Ron was interested in it. And Ron became very interested in being a film producer.
Yeah.
And was good at it.
Do you ever hear of Diane ever working for the company at all? I mean, did she have summer jobs or anything like that?
No, I never did. In fact, Walt didn't invite her and Lillian and her family to the opening of Disneyland even. He said, it's too much going on. I don't want to worry about you guys. Just stay home. So Diane was like, we saw it being built once in a while, but it was so, I think Walt was so preoccupied with it. But on the other hand, Ron was, one of his first jobs at the studio was running blueprints up and down the, Ventura Freeway to go down to, down to Disneyland, where the site of the park was. And in a funny way, he always joked that Disneyland would never be built if it weren't for him, because he was the one running the blueprints up and down the freeway. I think by doing that, he was starting from the ground up a little bit. And, Roy Disney, Roy Edward Disney, the Roy that we knew, did the same thing. Worked at editing, and they were not silver spoon kind of babies. They were really thrown into the lower levels of the company to learn the company. And that was the case with Ron.
Yeah. And he wound up going to USC to play football. And one of the things I didn't know was that I knew that he had played football with the Trojans at USC, but I did not know that he actually played for two seasons with the Los Angeles Rams.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he sure did. And his stories about those days, you know, and again, most all the stories that I know about him from the past 10 years when I knew him probably better than I did, or, you know, back in the 70s. But yeah, he, and it was back when football was football. Boy, you know, they occasionally, a few of the players had, you know, a little bar across the front of their helmets, but it was like old school tackle football. But yeah, he was drafted by the Rams. And I think that's probably one of the reasons Walt Disney wanted to take him under his arm, because he and Diane were having kids. And Walt, I think, felt like, I don't want my son-in-law running around breaking his neck on a football field when, you know, you got all these kids and grandkids around. And so I think he provided a place for him to work if he wanted to.
Yeah.
I was going to say,
I'm sure Walt was very persuasive.
I think Walt was persuasive to anybody about any topic. And Ron was, you know, I don't want to, diagnose him, but he was an introvert, I think. And I'm very much that way too. Meaning he was great in front of people and in meetings and everything else. But I think he was happy to have quiet time to recharge, and he was somewhat introverted in his manner. And so I think Walt was not an introvert and very happy to kind of step in and offer Ron some places where he could grow in the company. And Ron could have said no, but he saw it as an opportunity.
Yeah, I read something about him getting knocked out in a Rams game where a player called Dick Night Train Lane, you know, basically tackled him, and he was out cold. And I think that's where Ron or Walt was prompted to kind of persuade Ron to not be a professional football player anymore. And I think a lot of the players back in those days didn't last the length of time that you see players running today.
Yeah.
You know, they're not playing for 10, 15 years. They're lucky if they can do 5.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so true. For a number of reasons. I mean, Ron, off the record, so no one please repeat this, but Ron used to say they used to send him, even as early as USC, send him to the dentist and so the doctor to get injections in his knees when his knees were giving out halfway through the season.
Wow.
You know, to get some painkiller medicines and then back on the field. And I'm sure that happened and still does. But it was, again, a very different time.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. Yeah. So, you know, he really started essentially co-producing in the 60s.
Yeah, I think he saw a big opportunity to be a film producer.
And I mean, what do you think that was like for him? I mean, is that just on the job training, just getting thrown in the deep end and swimming with some people?
I think so. And I think, a couple things. Ron really admired Walt Disney. And yet was still able to be his own man. And so Walt at the time, I think in the 50s, was very distracted by Disneyland in the early 60s, by television, by Disneyland, all those things. So I think Walt was probably, and again, this is just me connecting the dots, but probably really happy to have somebody that would be really interested in motion pictures and movies, because Walt was down in Anaheim half the time. And the other times he was overseeing some of the movies, but most of the theme park stuff and expanding the company and buying land for Florida and all that stuff. So, you know, I think generally Walt must have been happy to see his son-in-law take some interest in motion pictures. And Walt was really generous, I think, with his producers. There were several of them. You know, Jerome Cortland. I don't know if you remember Jerry Cortland, Dave, and you know, just some producers that were around for years. And Walt made deals with them to be reasonably lucrative, where they could. This is too much information, but I'll give it to you anyway. Those producers, that short list of 3 or 4 producers, including Ron, could invest in the movies, like the Herbie movies or whatever, and then get a return off of those movies. So they had an ability to put some personal capital into those movies as a producer. And then they would benefit off of that. And Ron would and Ron and the studio would benefit off of that. And it was a way for the studio to delegate their movie production to a group of pretty talented producers. And it was a way to free up Walt Disney to keep doing what he was interested in.
And because they'd have skin in the game, Exactly. You know, they were wanting to make sure it was going to be a success. You know, it wasn't just collecting a paycheck.
Yeah. And that pretty much ended with that era when Eisner and Welles came in. I don't think it was unusual to give skin in the game to producers. That still happens. But it was a reasonable, generous kind of amount of money. So if you look at that era of, Apple Dumpling Gang and Black Hole and Watcher in the Woods and
Son of Flubber.
Gus the Field Book and Mule.
Oh, no, Flubber. You know, come that on. Darn cat.
It's we could go on the Boatniks. Anyway, we laugh at it. But internationally, if you had a couple of cents, a couple of dollars income off of those movies, it was significant. It was good. It was good. So all those producers did well. And rightly so. You know, they were compensated well for what they did. And a big part of keeping the legacy going.
Well, you know, I was looking at his screen credits and, you know, he was a executive producer on Escape to Witch Mountain, Freaky Friday, which is a huge classic. I mean, who doesn't like that movie? The Rescuers, Pete's Dragon, The
Treasure of Matacumbe. Yeah. I mean,
Tron. For crying out loud, Tron and The Black Cauldron. Well, it's The Black Cauldron, but I have a special I have a special place in my heart for The Black Cauldron.
We all do.
Aljon knows that.
It's all good.
Yeah, we do too. It's all good. You know, years of therapy have cured all that. But I mean, really, it was a good time. You know, one could argue the merits of those films, but they really were popular in large part. And in a funny way, a lot of them have been remade now, like Freaky Friday and a lot of the animated films.
Yeah,
and it's about time we bring back Apple Dumpling Gang. I mean, there's no comparing Don Knotts to the modern actors, but I think it's time we bring him back.
You know, I have to say, though, I love Son of Flubber, because, you know, in my mind, Fred McMurray, those were the quintessential Disney films of the 60s really were. With Fred McMurray. I mean, just fabulous. They were very entertaining.
Yeah, so Ron had a title on almost all those movies, including the animated movies. And he was not just in title, he was in the room, you know. So if you had reels to present or whatever, you know, you take him to Ron, and he had to buy off on the concept of what movies we were making next and then generally oversee it, although there were producers and directors certainly on every day to keep the animation moving ahead.
Now, after Walt passed away, obviously Ron was being groomed for higher up in the company, because he does become president of Walt Disney Productions in 1980. And that was prior to that was Card Walker was the president.
Right.
When Card Walker was president, was Roy O the CEO of the company? Because Roy O stepped back in after Walt passed away, right?
He was around almost all the time. And it was over those years. I don't know the exact, I don't want to speak to it too much because I don't know the exact chronology of it all. But between Don Tatum, who kind of preceded Card Walker, and then Ron Miller followed Don Tatum and Card Walker, that little group of managers and executives were running the company for a long time. Don Tatum was not as much of a day-to-day kind of person. Yeah. Card Walker was there every day. And as we said earlier, he grew up in the company. And then Roy O. Disney was there until the opening of Florida.
Right.
Yeah, in fact, Ron, I had lunch with Ron one time up in Napa, because after he left Disney, they pretty famously now moved to Napa and started a winery, which is excellent winery. If we can put a plug in for Silverado.
Yeah, a killer winery, Silverado.
Yeah, is the Disney family, the Miller family. And so I think that move to Napa was important for everyone's mental health.
Yeah.
And, it was a chance to then, reevaluate and kind of pivot where the company might go in the coming years. So in 84, Card Walker was still around, Don Tatum was still around. And then it kind of exploded with, Eisner and Welles coming in and Roy E. Disney coming in. Roy and Ron Miller, though, famously had a conversation after Walt died, and Ron went over to his, I guess it would be his uncle's house, to Roy O's house in Toluca Lake. And so, well, what are we going to do? Because Walt's died and we bought all this real estate down in Florida, which Walt bought. And so what are we going to do with it? And so Ron and Roy Disney sat down and said, well, we could either trash it all and just say there's no more Walt and we haven't really built Disney World yet, so let's hold on. But to their credit, the two of them really are the ones that said, you know what? We know what we're doing. We got to keep this thing going ahead. It's not a museum. Let's keep it moving ahead. And Roy and Ron decided on behalf of their families, Roy's family and Ron on behalf of Walt's family, decided to move ahead and build Walt Disney World. Mm. So that was how personal it got, which I think is wonderful, that it wasn't a big board meeting and votes and everything else. It was really two gentlemen from two different families getting together and saying, yeah, it's our legacy. We have to go ahead with this.
And it was really about completing Walt Disney World and also CalArts. Those are the two things that Roy O wanted to get finished.
You have said a mouthful there, boy. That's really important to throw CalArts into that, because those big unfinished dreams, one of which was Walt Disney World or Disney World, which became named Walt Disney World, you know, as a tribute to Walt Disney, became a huge construction project and probably was not that healthy for Roy O. Disney to undertake at his age. But then CalArts, yes, I mean, a very difficult project because it didn't have the Disney Mickey Mouse kind of background to it. It was built in an era, and I'm just blathering on here, so interrupt me, but it was built in an era when one could argue that Vietnam was going on, the culture was changing, there were protests everywhere, protests at Disneyland at different times, and the zeitgeist, the public sentiment of post-World War II optimism had shifted. And yet now an art college became kind of a home of controversial modern art and a home of new ways of looking things and a home of naked students running through the hallways and, you know, things that weren't necessarily connected with Disney, but important for an art institution. So that became a big story, founded in Walt's time while Walt was alive. And he, you know, showed the CalArts promotional material during the opening of Mary Poppins and all that. But still a miracle, really, that it got built. And even more of a miracle that it stands today as the institution that it is.
I'm just going to pop up while you were talking. I pulled up a photo I want to show you, and I think you've seen this photo before, but this is the groundbreaking for CalArts. And there's Ron Miller towering over Lily and Disney. Who's got a shovel, and you've got Roy E., our friend Roy E. right here on the other side, and Lulu May.
Who was the head of the LA Conservatory of Music, right?
Lulu May Von Hagen, I think.
Great
it is.
Name.
Yeah. And I thought it was just a great picture to throw up because, you know, there he is. And this is May 3rd, 1969. So it's, just a mere almost 3 years after Walt had passed away.
It is amazing. I mean, it's a beautiful facility. If you haven't seen it, the architecture of it is beautiful. I don't know. I always wanted to go there. And Dave, you not only went there, but have been very involved as a alumni in that school and, know more about it than almost anybody.
Yeah, I just, it just sort of struck me as, after Walt passed away, these were the two main things that the family wanted to accomplish, really led by Roy O. and Ron, and that was Walt Disney World and CalArts.
Yeah, and in a funny way, CalArts is, one could argue, is the most important institution that Walt Disney left behind, because if you add up the key players that were educated in there in the 70s, let's say, they are now the leaders of the industry. They're the leaders of animation, of acting, of music, of all those things. So the from an educational standpoint, here's this guy, Walt Disney, who barely graduated out of the eighth grade, is suggesting that this institute, this artistic version of Caltech, be built on a hill initially above the Hollywood Bowl. And there's great illustrations of how that would work, where CalArts would be a partner with the Hollywood History Museum and all that stuff. Well, over the years, that's disbanded. And now the Academy Museum is down in Los Angeles and CalArts is up in Valencia, which is a beautiful campus.
Yeah. The location at the Hollywood Bowl was really going to be almost a vertical, the institute in a building, a vertical building, really not much of a campus.
Yeah, really. And so smartly, they bought land out in the burbs and built it on a hill there. And a lot of people came, and a lot of people still come. It's a great, great institution.
Yes, it is. It is. What one of the things that struck me about Ron was, you know, he was really somebody I thought who had a vision. You know, he wanted to push into cable television with the Disney Channel, which he did, but also setting up Touchstone Pictures. Because I think he, like many people, knew that the Walt Disney Pictures label was a specific audience, and you couldn't do, say, a movie like Splash with, you know, that Ron Howard directed with Tom Hanks. You couldn't really do a movie like that under the Walt Disney Pictures banner, although probably today you could. But back then, you know what I mean? Like more adult fare. And by setting up the Touchstone label, it seemed like that was his, on you know, his entry into that world.
It was. You could argue it was inevitable, but it had to be done at some point. But there was tremendous pushback by the Disney fan community and Roy and everybody else to say, you know, you can't mess with the brand. And part of that was you can't put movies out on videotape. Of course, that was proved wrong over time. And then part of that was you have to be really careful about the content. And that still rings true. But things like, you know, for example, Nightmare Before Christmas was not a Disney branded movie, nor was Who Framed Roger Rabbit. And we think of those as very Disney now, but those were controversial movies in terms of, you know, it can't be a kid's audience. And I understand that. And things have changed a little bit where now I think people can take that subject matter and, you know, absorb it.
Well, that, you know, for Nightmare Before Christmas, they did strip off Touchstone and it is now Disney.
Absolutely so. And I think the same with Roger Rabbit, if not, and there's Roger Rabbit attractions at Disneyland now, which is, I mean, there's Star Wars attractions at Disneyland and all that. So I think the very huge dividing lines between what is Disney and what can't ever be Disney are not evaporating, but they're somewhat blurring, you know, with Star Wars in the parks, Marvel in the parks, it blurs a little bit. And I guess I could make a very Disney purist argument, which I won't, that stuff shouldn't be in the parks. But I don't believe that really. I believe the parks have to change. And I believe the variety of storytelling that brings to the parks is inevitably a good thing.
You know, I agree with you. And if you go back to when Walt opened Disneyland, I mean, he famously said this park will never be finished. It's always going to be evolving and changing. So I would think, you know, adding a Star Wars land is not a bad thing. I mean, the fans loved the Star Tours ride in Tomorrowland. That was a natural thing. So now that the company owns the Star Wars franchise, there's nothing wrong with putting that in there. And for the purists, don't go into that land. Go visit visit the parts that you like. You don't have to go into that land. You know what I mean?
I think also you go to a place like, I've been lucky, and perhaps you have too, to go to Tokyo Disney Seas.
Yes.
There's nothing there that is reminiscent of a Disney movie or brand or Marvel or anything else. And yet it's completely Disney. In fact, the most spectacular Disney park by far. So I think what is Disney and is quality and quality of entertainment and storytelling and those kinds of things, it can be put on a number of things. And I think Tokyo Disney Seas it kind of demonstrates that.
I agree with you 100%. In fact, I often tell people that I think the Disney Tokyo Seas Park is the crown jewel in the park's system. Yeah,
it's unbelievable.
It really is unbelievable. There is one thing that is to me Disney, and that's the when you go through that tunnel into the volcano, and the Nautilus, the full-size Nautilus is anchored there. And it's like one of the most spectacular reveals in that park.
It is. I mean, I hope your listeners get a chance to go there if they haven't already.
Without question, I think it's a destination. If you only do it once, you should do it because, you know, the park is just absolutely every corner you turn. The attention to detail is off the charts.
Yeah, and to get back to our topic of the day, who was running the company when Tokyo Disneyland was broken ground and started was Ron Miller.
Ron Miller, yes.
Art Walker, all those guys. Yeah. What a risk that was. And just to say, you know, we're going to get Oriental Land Company and we're going to finance it. We're going to have this Disney stuff here. What a huge leap of faith. And that was in the very early 80s.
Yeah, because Ron Miller was president of Disney from 1980 to 83, and he was the CEO from 83 to 84. So really, when you think about it, in four short years, he gets Touchstone going. He gets Tokyo, the park in Tokyo, Tokyo Disneyland going.
Yep.
He's also experimenting with computer animation with Tron, 1982.
Epcot Center.
He's funding Tim Burton. And he's you know, money's going to Tim to do his stop motion short Vincent in 82.
Yep.
And then Frankenweenie in 84.
So true.
You know, I mean, when you really think about it, and not only that, and you would probably know much more about this, he planted the seeds for Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
Oh yeah, that was around much earlier than the Eisner Wells Katzenberg days, because it was being developed by Darryl Van Sitters and Mark Sturtevant and a bunch of pretty talented people, including future director of Frozen. You know, was on it for a long time. So that those movies come and go, and they get developed by different people. But once Eisner and Wells came in, that became a movie that Bob Zemeckis and Steven Spielberg wanted to do, and it took off like a rocket. And we both benefited from that because we both worked on it.
We had a lot of fun on that.
I often
think about those days. In fact, we had interviewed Fraser McLean a number of weeks ago, and we were reminiscing a little bit about that. It was a really fun time working at an old electrical parts building in Camden Town, London.
Yes.
Right, and off the high street.
Yeah, and I think the average age of our studio back then was about 25 years old, which was not uncommon when they started Snow White and Pinocchio. It was the same.
Even though we all acted like we were 12.
Yeah, we did. We kind of downplayed our age a little bit. But Ron was amazing. And, you know, those years, I think, from 83, 84, 85 were difficult. But I think there's also a lot of revisionist history that has gone on about that time, because Ron was the one that brought in and started to talk to Michael Eisner. Michael Eisner reached out to Ron, and the two of them got together, and Eisner said, you know, I'd be interested in being part of Disney. And I think Michael, in his plan, wanted to be the head of Disney, the CEO of Disney.
Right.
I think Ron, in his plan, saw Michael as someone who could run the pictures division under Ron. But they got along well. I don't think there was any animosity there. I think there was respect between the two of them. It just didn't work out. And I think to get Eisner in the company with help from Roy E. Disney and Stanley Gold and that whole season, which we don't have to get into because it's been well documented in books and movies and things. But I think that was rough on Ron. Walt Disney was gone. The parks were built out. Tokyo was on its way. Epcot was on its way. And I think the company had a big pivot point. And you know, that's where 84, 85 kind of came into play.
Yeah, I think it was a bit of rough sledding. And I think the unfortunate thing about that change of management that happened was the rift that it put in the Disney family, you know, between the Roy E. and the Roy O. side of the family and the Walt side of the family. I think that was that was the fallout from it, which was sad.
Well, I don't think Ron Miller or Diane or anybody from that side of the family, Walt's side of the family, even visited Disneyland for 30 years, maybe.
Yeah.
And were invited back graciously just a few years ago to come to some of the anniversary ceremonies and things. And I think now with time passing, it's not as much as it used to, but there wasn't, it was a very tense relationship between Ron and Roy Disney, not Roy O, but Roy E. Disney.
Yes.
And I could get into what I think are reasons for that. I think, you know, I think there was some jealousy there that Ron was picked as the leader of the company when Roy E. Disney might have felt like he at least deserved a piece of that. He was on the board, but he never felt, you know, like he was really given the reins to the company as much as perhaps he felt he should have.
Yeah.
Hard to say though. And again, it's unfair to me to make a diagnosis on the relationship.
You know, something, as much as I talked to Roy E. over the years about some of that period, the one thing that I did know, I think in some sense, you know, he was wistful or, you know, felt a little bad about how things played out. Yes. But in the later years, he did have a relationship with his cousin Diane, and yes, they did talk on the phone and you know, periodically, and they communicated about various things.
Definitely so, and I think particularly when there were, you know, in later years when they were changing executives in the company, when Michael Eisner was on his way out, I think there was a good relationship between the family. It's hard, you know, a family run company is always difficult. Any company is always difficult, but
and especially during that kind of a transition, you know, where it really is sort of losing the family, you know, control, and it's becoming this big sprawling public company, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's become bigger with the years. You know, I haven't been around the company in a really active way for 10 years, probably. Believe me, that's for the best, because I think there is a time in all of us, in corporate America and in politics in America, when you're 80 years old and you shouldn't be governing anymore, ladies and gentlemen. And I don't speak that as a criticism against any particular person in politics. I just feel like, hey, what happened to the 40 and 50 year olds? You know, can't they come in and govern? So I think there's a chance to bring in some fresh people. And again, whether you're conservative or liberal or whatever, however you see the world, those fresh faces are really useful in a corporation. And I think that's what kicked the company in the pants in 1984. And it just took off like a missile. And I think that's a little bit of that happened when Marvel came in, and a little bit when Lucasfilm came in. And I think it's probably ready for that kind of shakeup almost any time. Yeah, it's hard to run a corporation, and it really does need fresh air once in a while.
Yeah, no, I think, you know, with the pandemic and the change of leadership, there's certainly been, you know, some rough sledding over the last couple of years.
Yeah, and you know, it's easy to point fingers and say, well, it was Eisner's fault, or that was Ron Miller's fault, or that was Bob Chapek's fault, or that was Bob Iger's fault, or whatever. I always think that's tremendously unfair, because yes, they are the leaders, but it's a very patriarchal point of view to say, it's just that guy who screwed it up. It's a big ensemble of people, and there has to be leadership for sure, but it has to be a kind of group vision for how to run a company. And that has existed on some very wonderful long runs at companies like Pixar and Disney and Apple. And it gets disrupted just like it does in any human activity, whether it's sports or corporate America or anything. And if you have a sports team that can solidly win for 10 years, let me know, because I'll put my money down. But it doesn't exist. And so you really have to look at these things of Ron Miller's contribution and his place in the entertainment industry as part of a pretty successful time, I think.
And you know something, I don't think I'm going out on a limb by saying this, but I think Ron Miller sort of set the stage for that, you know, reignition of the company, if you will.
He sure wanted to. For example, who brought in Touchstone Pictures?
Yeah.
Who brought in Tom Wilhite, who was a young, fresh executive that brought in a lot of projects and gave the reins to people like Tim Burton and so forth. You know, it really did take off. At least the aspiration of the company was to take off when Ron was still very much there.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. What do you think Ron's legacy is? Now that we're spending a whole show talking about him and really giving giving him his due, because he really has done a lot of stuff. He wasn't just Walt's son-in-law. He was his own person.
Yeah, he was. And I think that showed up even after he left the company, and his management of, anything from a winery, which sounds like fun, to a bunch of charitable work he did, supporting things from the Walt Disney Concert Hall to the opera and symphony in San Francisco and that kind of thing. So the thing is, though, he was a humble guy. And I think Diane and Ron both were not ones to steal the limelight. And so his legacy may be a very private thing and be left to the few people that may have known them. That's why something like this is important to talk about. I don't pretend to say that I knew him well, but I do feel like there was a contribution that he made that would not have led the company in a good direction had he not been there.
You know, I think you said something really important. It was, you know, I think a lot of the stuff he did after he was an executive at Disney really has a lasting, profound impact on California, because the Walt Disney Concert Hall, the Walt Disney Family Museum.
And you mentioned CalArts, huge.
CalArts, but also Silverado Winery. Yep. I mean, honestly, it is a great wine brand. Yep. Really is.
And USC, which they contributed to, and you know, so many different organizations in terms of their philanthropy. So, but again, they were not ones to grab the headlines. And I think that's consistent with you know, Roy O. Disney and other executives in the company that felt like, you know, we're here to do the work of the audience, and we're here to make great films and theme parks for the audience. And it's not about us, it's about the audience. And I think that's still to this day the best attitude to take when you're in this business.
You know, a lot, you know, I hear from people, and I'm sure you do, there's some people grumbling about this, that, or the other thing. And one of the things that I've always said was, I choose to enjoy the parts that I want to enjoy. Yeah. And that's what's so great about a company this large and this diverse. There's things that everybody, regardless of, you know, who you are, you know, where you are politically, all of those things, there's those things that you get to go and really enjoy, and you don't have to pay attention to the things you don't like.
Yes.
You know, and I think that's important, because to me, when you step through the gates of the park, or you sit back and the theater lights go down and you're watching a movie, you want to leave all that other junk out. You want to have that Absolutely. 2 hours in a theater to enjoy a movie, or you want to be able to walk down Main Street and not think about politics. You want to leave that behind. You want to step, you know, walking down Main Street is sort of the portal into this fantasy world, you know?
Totally.
And,
so.
And when you get to the hub, you get to choose where you're going to go.
Yep.
You know?
And yeah, boy. And these guys affected a popular culture so much. I mean, for example, another thing which we haven't talked about, the Olympic Committee decided to give the Olympics to Squaw Valley. Squaw Valley now has been renamed because the term squaw is derogatory in some circles, which is understandable. But at the time, it was called Squaw Valley, and it beat the Olympic Committee voted to put the Olympics there over Innsbruck, Austria, which was like the home of winter sports, by just two votes. And so the Olympics go to Squaw Valley. Squaw Valley was basically a chairlift in a parking lot. There was nothing there. And they immediately went to Walt Disney and said, okay, here's what's happening. Not only are the Olympics coming to this parking lot, we do have a rope tow, but that's about it. And we're televising for the first time. CBS was going to televise the Olympics in 1960, and they had nothing. And so Walt Disney, whose legacy I think rides on in all of the Olympics from then on, because the opening parade and the entrance of the nations and the televised, you know, a torch coming in and being relayed across the state, and I go on and on, was all because of that 1960 Winter Olympics and Walt Disney putting it on. Well, who was in charge of that from the Disney company was Ron Miller. Ron Miller needed somebody from a business and oversight point of view to kind of wrangle all that. And he said, Ron, this is yours. Go for it. Ron Miller pulls the whole thing together with the team, with so many people, with great designers and Imagineering people. And that legacy still lives on in the Olympics. And, you know, so there's something again that Ron was really central in.
That's amazing. I had no idea about totally that. I had never heard that. I knew that there was some stuff going on where they were going to, the Disney company was going to potentially do a ski resort at some point. Was that all around that same time?
No, it came later. Okay. That was Mineral King up in Sequoia.
Okay.
No, this was, Squaw Valley was an established chairlift. And again, it was a parking lot. And the owner of the resort kind of bluffed his way into getting the Olympics and then did kind of what we would call, if you'll excuse my language, a holy shit moment, and said, oh man, I promised this thing and I'm not sure how to deliver. And then just knuckled down and went to the guy he knew who could deliver, which was Walt Disney. And to his credit, all those giant ice sculptures we see and the medals of the nation and the dish with the flame and all that stuff, Walt Disney. And Walt Disney, by the way, for the next 60 years up until today, when you go to the Winter Olympics or any of the Olympics and you see those parade of nations and all that stuff, Walt Disney.
And so, Ron Miller.
That's Ron, Ron Miller. Yeah. Tremendous, yeah. Tremendous legacy going back to 1960. I mean, that Olympics started a lot of things. I mean, the opening statement read by the athletes for the first time, a woman read that in 1960, you know, so a lot of things were kind of breaking into the modern world at that time. And Ron Miller was the head of the whole thing. It's a fascinating story.
Wow. Well, he really did a lot. I'm glad we had a chance to really chat about him. And, you know, I go back to what I said at the beginning. I didn't really know him, but he was a friendly guy. I remember saying hi to him in the main hallway. And, you know, I think back that, back in those days, it didn't matter who the person was. Everybody was friendly. Everybody said hi to one another when you were in the hallways.
They used to hold the door for you and just, you know, if they saw you coming, they go, "Hey, Don, how's it going?" They wait for you to get up to the doorway so you could get in.
Yeah.
Very, very collegial. Humble. That's all I can say. Humble. They weren't the kind of people to brag on what they were doing, and yet they were doing extraordinary things.
Yeah.
Wow. It was the first Olympics to use metal skis, you know, instead of wood skis.
Wow.
They didn't have enough money to build a bobsled run. So they didn't have bobsleds that year. So there's things like that it just makes
the Jamaicans were disappointed.
I know. Yeah, they were, but they came back and they had their day. And then CBS television, had their time to film it. And for example, one of the skiers missed a gate back then. And it was the first time that they asked CBS if they could replay it just so they could see if the skier actually missed the gate or if it's something that people misunderstood. And so they backed up the tape and they showed it again, which was they fell into the idea of instant replay, basically.
Wow.
CBS on the Squaw Valley Olympics with Walt Disney and Ron Miller.
That's fantastic.
Wow.
That's so great.
That's unbelievable. I had no idea.
That's why I'm here, to give you useless facts.
Oh, well, listen, I have to say, I want to thank you so much because it was so great to have you come back and talk a little bit about Ron Miller. And as you can hear, our studio audience is going nuts.
I am happy to do it. Ron was a cool guy. And if I'm able to kind of put a spotlight on him for a while, I'm happy to do it because he was a good guy. And a lot of what's going on at Disney now would simply not be there if it weren't for his leadership.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All of these guys were building on the shoulders of giants, you know, and continue to do so.
Yeah. Did he make mistakes? Yes. Did Walt Disney and Michael Eisner and Steve Jobs and everybody else make mistakes? Absolutely. We're humans. And yet he ran a very dynamic, interesting company for 10 years, you know, at least or more after Walt's death. And that was huge. That was huge. He started the archives, for God's sake. I mean, Ron Miller calls up this guy who's working at UCLA almost as a student named Dave Smith and says, "Hey, can you come over and archive Walt's office? Because we want to just move it around a little bit." Dave Smith comes in for months and sits in Walt's office and archives every book and every piece of paper and everything in every drawer. And then they put it in storage and Ron moves into that office. And yet everything was stored in archives so well that they began the archives and put Dave Smith in charge of it. The other thing that he did, I'm just going to blather on here.
Yeah, no,
three
keep
more
going.
Hours,
yeah,
other, keep which going. I think is perhaps the most important thing is animation and the studio was a real boys club. When he went to expand animation, because all the animators were at the end of their careers, they were 65 years old, they were retiring, and many people thought they should just throw in the towel. He sat down with Frank Thomas, Ollie Johnson, Milk Call, Wooly Reitherman, and decided to keep it going. Cal Arts was very much a part of that. And bringing women artists into the ranks was really important. Women were always a part of the company in terms of ink and paint, in terms of many parts of the process, but not always part of that kind of nine old men animators group. And that's when people like Lorna Cook and Linda Miller and Heidi Goodell and, so many people.
Kathy Zielinski,
these brilliant women came into the company. And that just was new. And that was Ron Miller responding to the times and to the idea. I mean, when I started there, you could not go to the roof and have a sandwich if you were a woman. That was a men's club. You could go up and have a beer and a sandwich.
That's the penthouse.
The penthouse club.
On top of the animation building.
Yeah. If you're a woman, you could go to the Ink and Paint Tea Room across the way or the commissary. But it was segregated by gender. And that fell away very quickly in the 70s under Ron Miller.
I mean, prior to that, when you really think back, the person that comes to mind is Mary Blair. Yeah. And there was a few others, but very few were in, and a lot of the women were in the cleanup ranks. They weren't animating.
Greta Davidson.
Jane Boyd. Jane Boyd was one of the few effects animators.
Yeah. Women were always part of it, but I think in a knee-jerk reaction to who was at Disney back then, it's hard to come up with women's names.
Yes.
Now, thanks to the work of Mindy Johnson and people like her, we're able to identify more women than before. But still, I think Ron, from an executive level, and Wooly really said, let's pull in a half dozen trainees, and half of them are going to be women.
Yeah.
And that was a big deal. The Ink and Paint women also in the same era, and I can send you a picture on this, were allowed to wear pants suits.
I'm in one of those pictures.
Yes. I mean, it sounds ridiculous.
I had a pants suit on. No, I had pants on.
Yes, I often wore pants
suits. I had pants on.
Thank goodness.
No, but if you remember, at the end of Black Cauldron, I was asked to help paint some cells. And I did it. And it was probably the best education I ever had. I always tell people that.
Oh, absolutely.
But I am in the Ink and Paint crew picture from the Black Cauldron.
Yeah, I mean, if you were in the Ink and Paint crew, you were kindly asked to, wear the appropriate clothing, which was a skirt or a dress, and that was up until the 70s. Yeah. But then, this goes back to a point we were talking about earlier, which the world was changing.
Yes.
And thank God. And
Ron was changing with it.
He sure was. He sure was. It was a tough pivot, but he sure was.
Yeah. I mean, you gotta remember during that period, there was a lot of people in at Disney that were in the "What would Walt have done?" mode.
Oh boy, that's the truth,
right? And to me, it seems that Ron was pushing forward where he could by doing Touchstone, by doing the Disney Channel, by experimenting with computer animation and supporting those kinds of things.
Yeah. I mean, and they ran out of stuff that Walt would do. It's like, well, he would have built Epcot. Okay. They built Epcot. He would have built Disney World. Okay. They built that. He would have done Jungle Book. Well, he did that. And pretty soon, like any of us, we run out of stuff. But CalArts, huge investment, and brought in a huge legacy of talent that we're still feeding off of today. If you look at the leadership of animation, not only at Disney, but around the world, it's all CalArts, many of them CalArts grads, yourself among them. And so that legacy of that period is surprisingly alive still.
Yes, it really is. Really is. There,
that's everything I know.
Okay, so that was fantastic. And Don, as always, thank you very much for coming on to the Skull Rock Podcast. We always enjoy having you, and it's always a great conversation.
Yeah, same here. Really flattered to be asked. Thank you.
We'll have you back. I know we'll have you back at some point.
Next time we can talk about Norm Corey.
Okay. Or Corny Cole or any number of people.
Exactly. Yeah.
All right, Don. Thanks so much. We'll see you soon.
Thank you, guys. Really appreciate it.
Skull Rock Podcast.
To infinity and beyond.
Exploring the outer reaches of the Disney galaxy.
Wow, you flew magnificently.
Well, how about that? Talking Ron Miller with Don Hahn and stuff I didn't even know about, Dave. I didn't know.
You know, it's always great to have Don on the show. And I just love having these kinds of conversations because we all learn something new. You know, there's always some little tidbit of a story that comes out. And I thoroughly enjoyed it. And always thank Don for being available to come on, especially because he knew Ron Miller, And I didn't really have the pleasure of getting to know Ron other than saying hi to him a few times in the hallways.
you know, his impact, especially with the Olympics and the contributions that he had on coverage of the Olympics. I'll never forget it. I told Kristen that story, and she was like, she was blown away. She's like, wow, yeah. That's like something that lives on, and just a pomp and circumstance of it all. Just absolutely amazing. And I'm so happy we had the opportunity to shine a light on this forgotten era of Disney history. But once again, if you love Disney history, you love pop culture and films, please tell your friends to subscribe to the show. Skull Rock Podcast, available on all your favorite podcast platforms. And leave us those reviews. They certainly will help us out in the algorithm, as it were. I hate saying that every week. It's all about the algorithm, but it is. You know, that's inevitable. You can't help it. But also be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all of our social media at skullrockpodcast.com. Drop us those emails to Dave and Aljon at skullrockpodcast.com, respectively. And don't forget to sign up for this amazing contest. It's free. Do it. All you have to do is follow our socials. Just go to our facebook.com/skullrockpodcast. Click the link to enter to win. It's a pinned comment. Enter to win the book, the Claude Coat Walt Disney Imagineer book. Claude Coat's an amazing, brilliant mind. Dave put together this amazing book with Alan, his son, with a foreword by Tony Baxter. You'll get a signed copy from both Alan and Dave for the Claude Coat's book. So do it now. We'll be announcing the winner toward the end of the month. Dave, you've got the final word.
Well, it's pouring here in New York, so I have to say, I hope everybody has a fantastic week ahead. Be safe as you're out on the roads because of the weather, and we'll see you back here next week right here on the Skull Rock Podcast.
Travel safe, Dave.
Thank you.
Skull Rock Podcast is made possible by listeners like you. We'd like to thank our producers, Lindsay Scaffey, Spencer Wright, and Joshua Volkert. You can support Skull Rock Podcast by visiting our homepage, anchor.fm/Skull Rock Podcast, and click the support button. Become a producer today with your monthly donation and help sustain future episodes. And thank you for supporting Skull Rock Podcast. I'm Aljon Goh, co-host of the Disney List Podcast, as heard on Sorcerer Radio, as well as Skull Rock Podcast, here with my wife, Kristen. Hello.
Hello.
You are an earmarked agent who books Disney travel vacations for people all the time. Give our listeners a reason why they want to give you a call instead of just booking a trip by themselves.
Well, I can do all of the legwork for them. I have expertise. I've been to the Disney parks well over 100 times, so they've got that knowledge at their hand, as well as it saves them time and money.
Where can people get in touch with you so that they can book their next Disney cruise, Disney park trip, Adventures by Disney?
They can contact me at themeparksandcruises@gmail.com. I'm Kristen Hetzel, co-host of Dining at Disney Podcast. Every week, I chat about dining at Disneyland and Walt Disney World Resort and Disney Cruise Line with my fellow foodie, Bubba. We also feature restaurants and food reviews, information to help you plan your dining, Disney food news, recipes, and a monthly panel discussion. Visit diningatdisney.com and subscribe to Dining at Disney Podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcast, iHeartRadio, or your favorite podcast platform. Dining at Disney Podcast, the happiest plate on earth. I'm Kristen Hetzel, vacation planner, world traveler, Disney foodie, and theme park fan.
I'm Aljon Goh. I'm the husband who's also Disney, Star Wars, and Marvel Comics fan. And together, we host a Disney List Podcast.
Every week, you'll hear us list our favorite things about Disney theme parks, films, shows, travel, Marvel, and Star Wars in a top 10 list, rankings, and more.
That's an impressive list. Subscribe to the Disney List Podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, or your favorite podcast platform. You can even stream us on Sorcerer Radio at srsounds.com and check out our live shows on Facebook. The Disney List Podcast. Visit thedisneylist.com.